Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. I'm actually here in the Progressive Radio Network studio, and I haven't been here since they made the big move, and it looks fabulous. I'm really happy to be here, and I think it'll sound a lot better, so I'm excited about that. Unfortunately, you probably won't hear the Mr. Softy truck passing through like it always does when I'm recording from home, so we'll have to make that up later. I wanted to let you know, I mentioned this last week, we finished our Happy Halloween, or our Swingin' Halloween food show. It's a fondue party. We were finishing it up last week, and it's ready for you to view at the responsibleeatingandliving.com website. Part one is up, and part two will likely be up by tomorrow. It's really fun. I want you to watch it, okay? So visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, and then after you watch it, let me know what you think. And you can find me at info@realmeals.org. We had a lot of fun making it, and I hope you have fun watching it and trying out the recipes. We've gotten a lot of great response from our cashew cheese fondue. We made a lot of it, which is great because I'm getting to eat it a lot now. And one of the things that's great about this recipe is you can freeze it. So we made a big bunch of it, put it in different jars, and whenever we need a little cheese, we take it out of the freezer. It's really, really good. I also wanted to mention that we were out on a road trip this weekend, and it's always fun to do a little traveling. And one thing that really helps is to plan ahead and pack a cooler of all kinds of fun things to eat along the way, whether or not you're able to find restaurants or stores that have healthy food, it's good to bring some along. And if you visit my What Vegans Eat blog post, you can see some of the things that we enjoyed this weekend. I want to bring on my first guest, Judith Haskins. She is the younger daughter of Shirley and Morris Hyman. She grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, New York City, and attended Music and Art High School and earned her degree in comparative literature from City College of New York and a master's degree from City University in writing. Judith lived in La Jolla, California, as well as on the Riviera Maya in the Yucatan in Mexico. She has taught at various alternate and regular high schools in Manhattan, teaching English literature, and has been a vegetarian for 40 years and in the last 5.5 years, a vegan. She decided, along with her mother and sister, Sally Laura, to publish her late father, Dr. Morris Hyman's manuscript, Congenital Alterable Transmissible Asymmetry, The Spiritual Meaning of Disease and Science. Welcome to It's All About Food, Judith. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much, Karen, for having me on. Although I'm sorry that I can't be in your beautiful new studio because I'm with my 102-year-old vegan mother. She was 100 when the Shirley and Mo YouTube video was made of her. You heard about that?
I did. I just watched it earlier, and I posted it on my Facebook page.
Oh, okay.
It was really something and very inspiring. I especially loved, I'm not going to get it right, maybe you can quote it, but when your mom asked your father what she would do, how could she possibly go on without him after he died?
Right. Would you like me a few minutes to explain how this video came about?
Sure.
Which is quite interesting, actually. 3 years ago, when my mother was 99, on a very rainy February at Columbus Circle, a young man came up to my mother. She was under an umbrella, and she was heading to the swimming pool at my sister's apartment building on 57th Street. And this young man turned out to be Brandon Stanton, who is the author of Humans of New York, a best-selling book that has been all about amazing New Yorkers and their candid comments. Anyway, he took a very close-up photograph of her because he got under the umbrella with her, and he asked her if she had something inspiring to tell people, at which point my mother said that when my father was dying, she said, "Mo, what will I do without you?" And my father said, "Take the love you have for me and spread it around." Now, we had no idea that my mother said this to anybody on the street. She didn't come home and tell us anything about this. This happened in February. The following June, a friend of my mother's, and she has many, many friends, said, I was on American Airlines, and I opened the American Way magazine, and there's a picture of your mother, and the quote, take the love you have for me and spread it around. We thought, what in the world is this all about? Several weeks later, some other people called. Oh, this guy called Brandon Stanton is on TV, and he's talking about this 80-year-old woman that he met. He was on MSNBC. He was on the Ali Wentworth show. He was person of the week for Diane Sawyer. And finally, we thought, well, he's going around town describing an 80-year-old woman. He didn't know her name, and he didn't really know anything about her. But what had happened is when he went home that day, he looked at his blog, and he posted the photograph, and 81,000 people responded. And I believe what happened, we knew nothing about, I don't even know what a blog looks like, basically. After my generation. Anyway, but he was getting, I think, like 200 or 500 hits a day when he would post these photographs. All of a sudden, 81,000 people responded. So when we emailed him and said, hello, Brandon, this woman that you're describing as an 80-year-old is actually our 99-year-old vegan mother. Can we invite you over for some vegan cupcakes? So he did come over, and that was the following, it was January of 2014, and we had a wonderful time, and he took some beautiful photographs of my mother. And then we gave him some stories, and he put them on his website. And then he said, I'd like to make a video of your mother. And so that video was made the following February 2014. It came out in April. And apparently it's been very popular. So.
Yeah, it has. I really enjoyed it. It has hundreds of thousands of views, which is wonderful.
Well, that exemplifies the spiritual part of my father, the take the love you have for me and spread it around. Many people interpreted that as a very romantic comment, but in a way, he was saying transcend the romantic love that you have for your dying spouse, and once they've died, take that love and give it to all kinds of people that are not your spouse or your children or your mother, but go beyond that. And he always did that. He was full of love, but he was a doctor who practiced on the Upper West Side at the Bellnard, which I think is very close to where your former studio was, or maybe I'm wrong about that.
Upper West Side, we were at between 83rd and 84th
Well,
Street.
We're on 86th Street.
Ah, between, there you go. Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I would have loved to come to the studio, but because it getting through traffic at this time of the day, and I have to be home to give my mother a dinner, her vegan soup, etc. She's eating very well. She has a wonderful appetite. Anyway, she's 2 years older than she was in that video. She's not exactly the same, but she has, my sister and I like to say, she has 98% of her marbles, and my sister and I got the other two marbles.
Well, I want to talk about this book.
Right, right.
And I want to say, first let me repeat the title because it is a.
Should I explain the title?
Why not? Congenital, okay. Alterable, Transmissible Asymmetry, The Spiritual Meaning of Disease and Science.
Okay, well, first of all, the book was written in 1970, and my father never made any attempts to publish it. The first four words are his definition of true disease, or rather, disease. And then the spiritual meaning of disease and science. And my father was a deeply spiritual man, but not religious.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't ascribe to any religion or practice any religion whatsoever. And he makes that kind of clear in the first page of his only 144-page book, which, by the way, though, is very, very dense. But I think it's a wonderful read. Anyway, the first four words describe disease. Now, if you read the New York Times or you watch television, the word disease is used interchangeably with virus. For example, someone will say the Ebola virus, and in the next sentence they'll say this disease. Well, which is it? Is it a virus or a disease? My father makes the distinction, and it's not a semantic one, that a virus is something you catch from outside. marauding bacteria, microscopic, he used to call them microscopic lions and tigers. In other words, you're being attacked from without. Whereas disease has, first of all, the inherited component, and diseases like lung disease, heart disease, and cancer. Although there's one of those four words he felt did not apply to cancer, and that was the alterable. But that's in the book, and that he explains each of those four very clearly. But disease has the inherited component. For example, you can be in a room with 1,000 people that have cancer. You're not going to catch cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to catch heart disease or lung disease. Now, why is this distinction important? Well, we've made a lot of strides with the infectious conditions, with AIDS, with Ebola virus. There are a lot of strides that have been made, vaccines and all that. Although the more vaccines that come about, the greater the problem arises and the more microbes. He mentions that in the book, too. By the way, I didn't write the book, and I'm not a doctor, so if I sound a little bit less than as sharp as I'd like to be, it's because it's not my book, even though I've read it many times. But with heart disease and lung disease and cancer, we haven't made those strides at all. I mean, you know, the war against cancer, look where it's going. Although I think it's very interesting that for us vegans, just yesterday, big news that the World Health Organization is finally conceding that, yeah, there is a link between meat eating and cancer.
Yeah. It's such old news, but it's new news, which is so crazy about it.
Well, my father became a vegetarian in the 1950s, and he was convinced then that there is a link between meat eating and cancer. He also was convinced that we evolved upon this planet as herbivores. And he wasn't talking about the teeth or the intestinal tract, but something else. And that's in the fourth chapter of his book, The Physiology of Man, in which he talks about the things that we manufacture in our body, the things that we require that we don't manufacture, which creates evidence of what our diet has to be. I'll give you an example. We don't manufacture vitamin C in our body, and yet it is a crucial vitamin, absolutely crucial. Linus Pauling did groundbreaking research decades ago on vitamin C and said we need very large doses of that. And my father was in agreement. And vitamin C, by the way, is not toxic, because anything that your body doesn't utilize will pass out when you urinate.
Mm-hmm.
Vitamin B complex and C, my father was very big on those two. Well, anyway, so we don't manufacture vitamin C in our body, and yet it is absolutely crucial. So that means that we had to evolve in a place on Earth where, and he believed the tropics, where we had access to fresh fruits and vegetables right off the tree, the branch, right out of the ground. And the minute you pick a fruit or a vegetable, it diminishes in the vitamin content. Now, what's interesting, and what also explains why we are not dairy eaters, why we should stay as far away from the milk of any animal as possible, what's interesting is that mother's milk, female human breast milk, has a lot of vitamin C in it. Did you know that?
I did. Well, when I read the book, I found that out.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, see, I'm good. So you read the book. I'm so happy. Well, anyway, but cow's milk, because cows manufacture vitamin C in their body, a calf has no need when it is nursing on a cow, has no need for extra vitamin C. On the other hand, we manufacture cholesterol in our body.
Mm-hmm.
No carnivore manufactures cholesterol in its body. So anyway, so you read the book. Well, I hope you found it interesting.
Well, what I wanted to say about it was, number one, when I first got it, I thought, oh, it's a thin little book. It won't take me long to read.
Oh, right.
And I read all the books by authors or people representing the book that I speak about on my show.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, I started reading it maybe Thursday or Friday, and
okay.
I went, oh, my goodness, this is very difficult to read. It's very difficult, and it takes some of the sentences are long. They may have double negatives in them. They have a lot of concepts, and not all of them are the same in the same sentence, so you have to digest a little bit at the time before
right.
you continue. It's
right. You really have to pay attention.
You have to, yeah. And normally I just zip through reading books. And,
this isn't a zipping book.
No, it is not, but I found it very poetic.
Oh, yes, I think it's beautifully written.
Beautifully. And then once I could digest something, I like relaxed in it, thinking, oh,
right,
of course,
right,
this is right, obvious. Somehow,
right,
like my soul knew or my consciousness
right,
knew.
Right. That's very nice.
And
hear.
it made sense. So I plowed through.
Well, I think people might get nervous that it's not a typical book. Today, typical books are books of one idea, like that guy Gladstone who wrote Blink. And a few of them, he had one idea or the tipping point, and I bought those books and I read them, and you can zip right through them, and they're fun to read. He would have one idea, and then he would take a million anecdotes, some interesting, some not so interesting, and squeeze everything in to make it fit. Like, ooh, that's what, but when you finish the book, it's like, what was I really reading? Was it really of any consequence? I have to say, I believe on, in my father's book, there's so many ideas mm-hmm. that people might never have read before. And yet, as you say, their soul might say, you know, this is absolutely true. You know, this is real. For example, the part about smoking, how he explains the effect of smoking on your body. Just recently, doctors have said, well, you know, smoking doesn't just cause emphysema and lung cancer. It affects other cells. Well, my father explained that when you put a cigarette in your mouth, every cell in your body is defending against this poisonous intruder. Now, he said it in a much more poetic way mm-hmm. than I did. You remember that, right?
Yes.
And I thought it was beautifully written. The thing is, I think people need to relax when they read the book and, okay, so I didn't quite get that. Let me move along. First of all, it's a book where you have to turn off all other devices. You can't be multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be watching TV, talking on the cell phone, looking at YouTube mm-hmm. videos. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. No, this requires 150% of your concentration.
Let me ask you a question. Will you read it again? Do you find it?
Well, I would like to. The thing is, I've always got all these different books thrown at me
okay.
for this
well,
program, but I've dog-eared many pages.
Okay. And can I ask you what your favorite insight was in the book?
Well, there were a number of things. So one of the things, he kept referring to the cell and how important it is to nourish all cells and that they all need to get the right nutrition. And when
right.
they and what I thought was fascinating at one point was talking about when one part of the body has a problem.
Right.
And, you know, I can't use all of his correct terminology, but let's
right.
say you have a heart failure or you have a problem and you're treated. He described how the whole body kind of goes down to that minimum functioning level.
Right, right.
And
right.
and so your body, when you have an issue somewhere, your whole body is going to drop. You're not able to work at maximum efficiency. And mm-hmm. and some of our drugs actually encourage that operating at
that,
a minimum.
Right. I think his point was that the drugs don't bring up the weakened cells, they weaken the other cells
mm-hmm.
so that to recreate a symmetry, because disease is asymmetry. It's off balance where not everything is functioning equally. So the drugs, people think, oh, I take a drug, like you take an aspirin, and you think, oh, it's curing my headache, got rid of the pain. No, it didn't get rid of the pain. What it did is dull some of the sensations in your brain. It weakened the cells in your brain that would perceive the pain. That's not really such a great thing, is it?
No.
The pain is there. I mean, pain is there to let us know there's something wrong. Yeah, I mean, so, well, good.
Yeah, there were a few other things I wanted to bring up, looking to see if I could find it. He was very diplomatic, I think, in expressing his discontent with current science and current medical practice.
Not always. I think he referred to it as a dismal sometimes.
Yeah. And so there, at one point he was talking about how physicians... Oh, here it is. Can I read it? Page 93, there is a similarity between physician and psychiatrist, which would be astonishing if we did not recognize that each originates from a comparable spiritual immaturity. For notice how identical is their confusion of shadows with reality, as well as therapeutic delusion, which seeks, on the one hand, to halt disease without restoring nourishment of the bereft cell, and on the other, to disperse the anxieties of the mind without inspiring the contiguous soul to that creation of beauty by which it ascends once more into its spiritual heavens. That's a big mouthful, but what I got from that is there are many mental illnesses and mental issues where people are in therapy forever or they're given drugs, whatever, but perhaps if they were encouraged to be of service to others,
they would
find ways to heal themselves.
My father used to take out his prescription pad. He made sure that he had a half an hour for every single patient, and he used to take out his prescription pad and write down, take care of a sick animal, do some volunteer work in a hospital. For him, spiritual was being concerned with the needs of others, being not a material person, but a person of concern for others who didn't put themselves first, who wasn't part of the me generation or the greedy generation. In fact, my father, he could certainly, if he were alive today, would never have been able to do it, but because my mother was a teacher, it was a two-income family, he charged $5 a visit for 30, throughout his 30-year practice. He never raised his fees, and if you never paid him, he continued to see you. And he said, I don't want to get rich on the backs of other people suffering. Now, and, you know, you can hear about doctors like this in small towns in the Midwest and everything, but when you're on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where all the doctors were driving Cadillacs and their wives were in minks, and my father was making house calls with his VW bug, and actually, now that I look back on it, in the 60s and 70s, he was putting his life at risk because New York City was a little bit of a more violent, prone place. It was also very interesting in those days, but people used to regularly break into his car when he was making house calls at 3 a.m. in the morning to get the syringes for the drug, you know, the drug addicts, and full of drug addicts in the neighborhood, and the prescription pads. He probably was the only doctor in New York City that had the MD license plate removed. He didn't want MD on his car anymore after they broke it. Now, that's a pretty good story. He also would be horrified at the amount of drugs that Americans are taking today. Absolutely horrified.
Yes.
He, my sister and I grew up probably the most drug-free, Upper West Side, middle-class people in New York that there are. I mean, I took no doctor prescribed medications whatsoever, maybe an occasional antibiotic, but very rarely. And, you know, today people are taking drugs, and look at the side effects. Look at the side effects. Look at the side effects of the drugs people take for mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is suicide.
Yep.
And we don't ask the questions, you know, what drugs. Look at Robin Williams. It's very distressing to me. I'm sure they said that he was on some psychiatrist prescribed drugs, but they don't make the link that, well, how many of people who put things around their neck and kill themselves? There was a Kennedy girl. The number of people have done this,
too many.
And they're not. What's that?
It's too many.
Yeah.
Way too many.
Okay, you're depressed, and now you might have thoughts of suicide. Where does it go if you're depressed and you start thinking about suicide? I mean, it doesn't go well, does it?
Not at all.
Well, since I've been a vegan, and you've been a vegan much longer than me, I have become convinced that aggression, depression, and anxiety can all be stilled by a vegan diet. And it's very interesting. I have my veterinarian for my dog the dog in the video, Chock Chock, who's now 15, he just became a vegan recently.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, he was a vegetarian, mm-hmm. and I had some talks with him about it. I'm not the one who influenced him, of course, but when I saw him, I see him only once a year or something like that. He said, yeah, and now he's a vegan, and he seemed very cheerful. And I said, do you feel any physical differences? Because I did, transitioning only from vegetarian to vegan. And he said, no, I always felt physically great. He said, but I do feel emotionally better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an emotional component mm-hmm. to it. And now they're talking about the gut, the bacteria in the gut, which comes from the various things that people eat, and how that affects mood and all this. All these people, you know, they talk about the people who are mentally ill. Oh, let's keep guns out of their hands. How about feeding them a better diet? How about every prison having a garden? How about every school having its own garden?
Amen to that.
Yeah.
So I just had like one more question because we're almost out of time, believe it or not.
That.
I know. So I'm thinking that most current doctors will not want to read this book.
No, they'll be very angry about it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that most of the public won't even be able to understand it, unfortunately.
Well, I think...
or at least have the patience to take the time to digest it. I want everybody to read this.
You do want everybody to read it?
I do. Of course I do.
You don't think it was a bad idea that we published it?
No, I think every doctor should read this.
Of course, we self-published because I don't think there's a publishing house in the world at this moment that would publish it. And yet...
Lantern Books might publish it.
Well, if half the things that my father said in this book are true, it's an astonishing work.
I just know that a number of doctors I've spoken to, and some of them are doctors that I've just gone to for medical reasons, and then some of them are the vegan doctors that I know and care very much about, really stay away from the spiritual portion of life and health. And
why?
I don't know. They're afraid, or they think that they won't be taken as seriously.
Exactly. Well, I have to just say very quickly, because we only have a few more minutes, my father, throughout his life, had what he would describe as mystical experiences. You're absolutely right, though. People think, what are you, a wacko, a crackpot? You know, what is this? But I would say the closest thing you could say to that is he saw the face of God. He had absolute certainty that we are reincarnated, that we go through various incarnations, and that the point of being alive is to grow spiritually and to get further and further on to an enlightened understanding. And in terms of health, he would advise two things. An herbivorous diet, I don't even think the word vegan was used when he wrote this manuscript, an herbivorous diet and a spiritual life. And with those two, you would be as healthy as you possibly could be. Now, we're all born with weaknesses, as he said in the book.
Well, people will have to find out more about that when they read this, and I highly recommend that they do. Judith,
I'm so happy you recommend it. I'd love to talk to you sometime.
I was going
to
say, maybe we can talk off air, and maybe I can have you back, but I'm not done talking with you.
Oh, you still have another couple of minutes left?
No. I have to go now, but I want to continue our conversation.
Well, I just want to say, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. And I'm also so happy that you read the book and that you got something out of it. And that's why we put the book out there, because we think there are many people, just like the 81,000 who loved what he said about take the love and spread it around. I think there's a spiritual vacuum. And, you know, you can put the philosophy together with the science. And it works just fantastically. Well, I thank you so much for
Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. We'll talk soon. That was Judith Haskins, and she was talking about her late father's manuscript, which they've recently published, called Congenital, Alterable, Transmissible, Asymmetry, The Spiritual Meaning of Disease and Science. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Let's take a very quick break, and I'll be back with my next guest, Elise Desaulniers. everybody. We are back, and I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. And that really was a mouthful, wasn't it, that last part? I really encourage you to read the book, but like we were saying before, you need to turn everything else off and focus 100%. But I believe you'll get a lot out of it. I know I did. Moving on to the next book that I want to talk about, Cash Cow. I have in the studio Elise Desaulniers. Desaulniers.
Yeah, you get it right.
Merci. She is an independent scholar and animal rights activist who published her first book on ethics, Je mange avec ma tête, which means I eat with my head, in 2011. She co-authored two articles in the Encyclopedia of Food and Agricultural Ethics and won the Quebec Grand Prize for Independent Journalism for a piece on feminism and anti-speciesism in 2015. A frequent lecturer and presenter at colleges and universities, she lives in I'm like saying half French and half English. Montreal, Montréal. Okay. Hello.
Hello. Thank
Elise,
you for having me.
Thank you for coming. All right.
Your French is very, very good. We should do the interview in French.
Okay.
That's yes, sir.
I would love to do that some other time, yes. I suppose, because I don't think my listeners would really appreciate it if we did it all in French right now.
It will be just you and me.
But just to explain a little bit,
yes.
I have studied opera and musical theater, and I was singing quite a bit in France at the time. So I really studied pronunciation. I've probably gotten a little more relaxed since I'm not living there anymore. And all speaking and pronunciation is related to muscles.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're not speaking a language, your muscles get soft.
Well, that's the story of my life in English. I understand English perfectly. I can write fine, but speaking is another thing, and the TH and other and all of that's terrible. So I'm sorry for your listener.
Well, I'm sure many people have told you that Americans love French accents and British accents,
yes,
and versions thereof, but we love those things, so don't lose that.
Thank you.
I first noticed this phenomenon about the musculature in the mouth when I moved from New York to California, and I lived in California for about 9 years, and then whenever I would visit New York and go back to speaking New York, I felt this weight in my tongue.
Well,
because New York is such a heavy language, and it just was so heavy on my tongue. It was a phenomenal thing.
So it's not only me, because when I speak English, it hurts, really.
It hurts to speak English.
I'm suffering right now.
That's funny. I also tell people when they want to speak French correctly, it's all in the lips. You must pout and look like you just want to kiss everyone. And then everything sounds so much better. All right, let's talk about milk.
Yes.
Milk. Milk is not a poison, you've said in your book, although some of us have called it a poison. But there's a lot of things that are not right with dairy milk or milk from animals.
Mm-hmm.
So let's jump into Cash Cow.
Yes.
Right. So why did you write this book?
Well, like you said earlier, it's my second book. So the first book was about food ethics in general, and I gave a lot of lectures on the topic. And, well, most people agreed with me, at least you should reduce your meat consumption. Even I'm vegan, and I'm talking about veganism, but they agree on some principle. But when we came to dairy, especially French, and Quebecers are the same, we love dairy, we love cheese, we love yogurt, so they agreed on the principle, but don't talk about dairy. Don't talk about cheese. Don't tell me to stop eating cheese. I said, well, there's something strange about dairy.
Mm-hmm.
There's something strange with our relationship with cows. There's something there that I should look in depth. So that's why I started researching. And I understood how my relationship with dairy and our relationship with dairy is built on false beliefs and that are probably made from the industry, advertising, but also the fact that cheese is good and it doesn't come direct. Well, it's not the animal flesh, so it's maybe harder to see the link between the animal suffering and being exploited and the thing we put on our bread. So it's complicated.
It's complicated. I'm not promoting dairy ever. But I'm thinking that a long time ago, hundreds, thousands of years ago, whenever we started consuming dairy products, it probably wasn't as detrimental to it, to us as it is today. People are consuming far more dairy products than ever before. And we didn't feed the animals or take care of the animals the same way as we do today. And I probably shouldn't even use the word care, because there's no care involved today, really. But there's a romance, and I think it started a long time ago, this romance with animals, and believing that what they gave us was good for us.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up. Nobody ever asked me a question about that. And during my research, I interviewed Renan Larue. He's a French researcher. He works on the history of vegetarianism. And he told me how, well, for most of our history, like, being vegan was not something you could imagine. We needed animals. We needed cows. Cows were useful in the fields and in our lives, so we were not always thinking about killing cows, but using them. We needed them, and using a bit of their milk for our own consumption was just fine. So we couldn't imagine living without cows, so we couldn't imagine being vegan. So for most of our life history, it was the case. It's completely different today, but that might explain why vegetarianism came before veganism, because, well, cows were just part of life. Same thing for hens.
I don't think when we started our relationship with cows that we were artificially inseminating them or raping them, which is what I like to say.
No, we were not.
And that's one of the worst things in my mind whenever I don't do this often. I don't care to do it. But when I go online and go to these university sites that describe how animals are artificially inseminated, it's just the most disgusting, horrific thing. And it's all considered on board and perfectly acceptable. But that didn't happen then. And the animal, the babies,
They lived with their mother.
They lived with their mother. It was a very different situation.
But the industry is still telling us that story, which is the past.
Yes, way past.
And even me, I mean, I went to university, I'm educated, I'm reading, and I spent most of my life, well, not thinking about it. But when I became vegetarian and quickly after became vegan, but in between, a friend asked me, how do you think milk is produced? Well, by cows. And she said, well, I think cows need to have a baby in order to produce milk. I was, no, are you sure?
Exactly.
And I mean, I'm reading papers every day, and I'm online, I'm researching, and I didn't know that. And I didn't know the link between veal and dairy, and it was all the same thing. I just didn't know that. So for most of people around us, they just have no idea. And when you look at the milk carton, well, you see a happy cow in the field with her baby, and it makes us feel good to think that reality is that.
Yeah, I think you mentioned in your book that knowing that there is a way to treat animals relatively decently, we somehow accept treating them horribly.
Because there's this slight possibility.
There's a possibility that it could be that way.
Every talk I give about dairy, there's always somebody sitting in the back, raising or is answering, like, but what if I have a cow in my backyard? Yeah, sure, you're living in Montreal, come on. But what if I have a cow in my backyard and I treat her nicely and she stays with her baby and blah, blah, blah? And that idea always come up. What if? And yes, of course, but it's what if, like,
I was
peace on the heart.
I had Dr. David Katz on the show a few years ago. He's a medical doctor and an expert in nutrition at Yale. And he's done some great work. He wrote a book, Disease Proof something or other. Anyway, his wife is French. And I once visited her blog, and she was talking about organic dairy. And I just very politely mentioned some of the issues that I thought she'd like to know about. And she was very polite and very gracious and said she has to find out more about this. Well, she got her milk from some local organic dairy, and she was went to that farmer and came back feeling better somehow, that it was okay. And then I came back again and said, you know, have do you see how he inseminates the cows, mm-hmm. by the way? And, you know, the conversation was done. But there are lots of people, not just French people, but especially French people, that really have a hard time.
Well, because
with this.
There's also a long part of the process that we don't see. Like you mentioned, we don't see insemination and we don't see the slaughterhouse. So yes, especially in France where cows go outside, it's not the case in Quebec where 94% of the cows are just inside and with chains and everything. They are not free at all. But in France, you see cows outside. So you imagine, well, it's fine and it looks good in the fields and all of that. So because we don't see all the process, and we don't think about it because it's going to make us feel bad thinking about it, it makes it easier to consume dairy. But you're right, organic dairy is the worst because you pay a lot more. So since you pay a lot more, you feel a lot better. And people that buy organic dairy want to do the good thing. So it's hard to tell them, well, no, it's as bad. I don't know for American organic milk. But in Quebec, well, it's cold, you know, during the winter and sometimes even during the summer. So cows go outside only once a week during summer. The rest of the time, it's exactly the same as the conventional. And the slaughtering is exactly the same. So it's...
Yeah, so there are so many issues, and this is the most important issue to me, which is the ethical portion, the cruelty portion. The reason why I became vegetarian and vegan is because I don't believe in causing pain and suffering. I don't want to kill animals, period. And I was very happy, delighted to learn that there are all these bonuses for not eating animals. It's better for the environment, it's best for the environment, and it's the best thing for my health. So yay for all of those good things. So let's just touch on the health and the environment for a moment.
It's important because when we question the dairy consumption, people will tell you, well, but what about your calcium? And what about that? And what about, so it's normal, natural, and necessary to consume dairy. You need to cover that. You need to explain, well, no, you don't need calcium. Well, you need calcium, of course, but you can find it in your green leafy, blah, 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 and we all know that. But there's also health problems related to dairy consumption. And for some people, that's the extra argument that will have them at least look at their dairy consumption. For instance, since cows are pregnant where they give milk, there is hormones in their milk, natural hormones. I know in the States you're adding hormones.
Oh, please.
Sorry. Yeah. But in Canada, we don't do that. We're really, really proud. We're Canadian. We don't put hormones in our milk. Well, yes, but your cows are pregnant. So since they're pregnant, there is pregnancy hormones in your milk, and you consume that. And that consumption is linked to breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, and well, it's some things you need to look at. It's an allergen. We talk a lot about a food allergy, but all those autoimmune reactions are reaction to the milk protein. So these are facts, and even Harvard School of Public Health agree with me on that, and they're not vegan, and they're not promoting veganism. But they say, well, you should consume less milk and find other sources of calcium and vitamin D that is added to milk and protein and stuff, yes.
Yeah. Phew.
Yes.
There's nothing good about milk.
No. And in terms of environment, we talk about meat and stuff, but of course your cows are also ruminants, so it's the same problems. And with water, you need three times more water to produce 1 gallon or liter or whatever of cow's milk than you need for soy milk. So in California,
please,
if you have listeners there who are turning off their water and being careful in the restaurant, not taking a glass of water to save water, well, good, but they should only switch from cow's milk to soy milk in their latte, and they would do so much more for water consumption reduction.
Drink soy lattes in California,
yes,
folks.
Please,
soy lattes,
please.
Or almond lattes. You know, I know the almonds are getting a bad press because they take a lot of water, too.
But it's still better than cow's milk.
That's right.
But soy is so efficient. So in your latte in the morning, switch to soy milk, and it's good.
It's good, and you don't have to worry about those phytoestrogens in the soy milk. They're not the same as the hormones that you find in cow's milk, which are so much more detrimental. The soy when you're eating a whole or minimally processed soy food, those phytoestrogens that you get there are your friends.
And even if you had breast cancer or at risk of breast cancer, like I am, my two grandmothers died from breast cancer, it's actually doing good for you. Mm-hmm. There's only one source that says that soy is bad for you, and it comes from the meat industry. So only one source, it's the meat industry. And of course, we're against them.
So how did you get so smart?
I don't think I'm that smart. I don't think so. Maybe by drinking soy milk, I would say. No, but I've spent my life doing tons of things. I've worked in advertising, worked for an airline, and a few years ago, I met a book on animal ethics, so philosophy book, like serious book with a lot of footnotes. My boyfriend ordered because he's a philosopher. And we didn't know, like, he's French and he likes cheese and everything. Not anymore, but at that time. And we didn't, he did his PhD in philosophy, never heard about animal ethics. But he ordered that book because he was teaching an ethics class. And, like, we heard it was like this new topic and odd. So, and I had the book in my bag, started reading it, and my first thought was, I have cats, I love them, and I'm eating animals that suffer, and I felt stupid. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I'm right, but I felt stupid not thinking about that by myself. Like, where do animals I'm eating are coming from? So I started reading, and you know the basic stuff, like Peter Singer and Regan and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, how come that happened around me and I never heard about it? And well, I put the fault that I'm on the case and that I'm French, and in French we don't have that much literature on animal mm-hmm. ethics, so it's probably because I'm French. But started reading in English about the topic and writing about it. For me, it was important to read and write at the same time, just to share my knowledge with people that needed that information. So I started blogging, and the more you write, the more you have to think. And inside, I was vegetarian and became vegan really quickly, but I tried to find ways to continue eating meat and cheese. But the more I was reading, the more I was convinced that I was wrong. So same for the boyfriend. He became vegan too.
Oh, good.
And we met a lot of people around us that were starting also to think about those issues. And right now in Montreal, I don't know if it's the climate that gives us a lot of time inside to read and think, but there's a lot of people working on those issues. We might be late, but I think like we're catching up. The young people in universities, in college, we call it cégeps, I feel like half of them are vegetarian or vegan or thinking about it, and like the intersectionality issues, like exploitation of animals linked to women exploitation, and
it's all connected.
It's all connected.
It's all the same.
But for them, it's like they all agree with that, and it's simple. There's something going on right now, and it gives me a lot of hope on the future.
That's very encouraging to hear. I just took a little road trip with my partner Gary this weekend. We like to see the autumn leaves, and we drove up north to Ithaca and then back down to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, near Bucknell, where I went to college a long time ago. And so we spent some time at the university, and number one, I found a little restaurant that served tofu scramble, which was amazing. It wasn't very good, but
it's amazing.
Glad it was
it's amazing.
There.
Yes.
It was there, and they served soy milk for my tea, and, you know, I was in heaven, and, you know, this is all new. And then you were mentioning reading ethics and philosophy. I met up with Dr. Gary Steiner, who is a philosopher at Bucknell, and he's written a number of books on animal ethics, and he's come up with the vegan imperative. That's kind of his catchphrase, and he explains what the vegan imperative is. I spoke to him on this show a few years ago, and he and his wife made a lovely lunch for us this weekend, which was all vegan and fun because we do a lot of cooking, and I post a lot of recipes all the time. We do food shows, and people are afraid to have us over, not just because we're vegan, but because we cook a lot. So it was really nice for people to make us meals. But I wanted to talk a little bit about France.
Yes.
because I did live in the south of France from 1992 to 1996, as we were talking earlier. Nobody talked about vegetarianism, and I never met another vegetarian at that time. And I was delighted years later to discover the Veggie Pride Parade originated in Paris. They came out of the closet, literally. And but I have to give my friends a lot of credit, because they did go out of their way whenever they had events to make sure that there would be food for me, which was really lovely. But I remember one man would talk about the foie gras. And he was absolutely convinced that the birds were delighted to be in their situation, how they would run for the food, they would run to have the tube shoved down their throat, and they were very happy.
Yes. Well, I've worked for an airline for many years. As I told you before, this airline was Air France. So when I became vegan, I was still an Air France employee and spending a lot of time in Montreal, of course, but also a lot of time in Paris. And first day being vegan, I used to travel business class. So I was really, really happy. I can try the vegan meal in business class. Well, it was terrible. the first serving was only veggies. Second service were the same veggies, but cooked with rice. And the third, the dessert was fruits. So, and the morning after, at the Air France cafeteria, there was nothing I could eat except rice.
A baguette.
And maybe rice, but it was tasting like chicken, so probably chicken. So it was terrible. So it was like 8 years, 9 years ago. And now I go back once or twice a year, and it changed a lot. Paris is the capital of gastronomy in the world, but it's becoming the capital of vegan gastronomy. There's really, really, really good restaurants, and like a new restaurant every week. There's a lot of really, really good cooks there that are writing books and like amazing books. I mean, they know what good food is, so when they cook vegan food, it's good. So it's changing a lot. And because of a few really influential people that have a huge influence. The group L214 in Lyon, they do amazing work. They are like Mercy for Animals, but in France. But they don't have much money, but they're doing huge things. So they do...
In Lyon.
In Lyon, but also all around France. And so there is things going on all over France to teach what veganism is, what vegan food is, the arguments, but they also do campaigns against foie gras around Christmas time. They did an undercover investigation in a slaughterhouse, and that video went all over the place in France. France suddenly realized what a slaughterhouse was, and they did the headlines and all the news. So there is a lot going on in France right now and in Quebec. At the same time, because like we talk to each other.
Of course. Well, I know that as soon as France and all related to France get over themselves, they will definitely take the lead.
Yes. Well, they're good thinkers. French philosophers are good philosophers. So now they're starting, and they will tell you that you're late. Yes, maybe. But they're starting to think about animal issues, and they will do great. I mean, if you look at all the Bush book published in France, in French on animal topics in the last years, there's a lot, and there's a lot going on. So I'm really proud.
I'm excited and sad at the same time, because I'm sorry it wasn't happening when I lived there. It was not easy. But in some ways, I want to think, well, maybe I, in some small way, I spread a few seeds when I was there.
Well, I think that's what happened, because when you look at the history, there's like you start to go from the beginning. There's always somebody saying, hey, I had this neighbor, I had this roommate, I had 20 years ago, and she told me, and that's my case, I had a vegetarian roommate, and I thought she was crazy, but I remember what she told me. And her arguments came back 20 years after when I read the book. So, yeah, every little seed is important.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Lyon, and I've told the story before, but when I lived in France, I was in Lyon first before I went to Aix-en-Provence, and my boyfriend at the time wanted to celebrate my birthday. So he called Chez Bocuse. Are you familiar with that restaurant? So Chef Bocuse,
I've never been there.
Is world-renowned. And So 2 weeks in advance, he asked, could you serve a vegetarian, a vegetalienne, like me? And they said, sure, no problem. And then 2 days before, he sent a fax to remind them. And we showed up, and they had no clue who we were. And the dinner was a disaster. And they charged an arm and a leg. And the French don't normally really want to be confrontational or argue in a restaurant scenario. But my boyfriend did talk to the maitre d' and told him the problem. And this guy was trying to explain, we have 25 chefs in the kitchen. We can't possibly do anything for you. I mean, it made no sense. It was the middle of the week. Nobody was there. And but I'm sure even in that restaurant, they could probably do something better today.
Well, now we have a chef in Montreal, and he used to work for Bocuse. And now he's working for Normand Laprise at Turkey, who's like the best chef in Montreal. And this guy is vegan. And you can hire him to cook at your place if you want. But that's interesting you mentioned végétalien. In French, we have two words for vegan. Mm. We have vegan and we have végétalien. And it's so complete. Well,
that's French.
Like everything in French.
There's always the French word and then the other word that everyone uses.
Yes. Yeah,
but Elise, I'm sorry we're out of time.
Oh, no.
Believe it or not.
Already?
Already. Déjà. So thank you very much for joining me. Please check out the book Cash Cow. Love the title. And learn more about why you don't want to consume dairy. And if you have family and friends who are consuming dairy, maybe you want to share this book with them. Okay. Thank you for joining me, Elise.
Thank you.
And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where you can find a phenomenal cashew cheese fondue recipe. I recommend it for Halloween and any time, any great party. Email me at info@realmeals.org, and remember, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.
That's it.